Today is Wednesday. Happy New Year. It's January 3rd, 2024. And it's 2:42 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Thanks for finding us. Share us with your friends and email us to johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute, and you can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on CW26 and the Making Podcast from WBEZ.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now running the strange Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the rapidly aging proprietor of the Picayune Sentinel, a fine Substack newsletter.
Rapidly aging.
What's that all about? What's bothering you?
My birthday is on Saturday, which is January 6th, which is the day that is living in infamy.
And No kidding.
I'm still mad about the insurrectionists who hijacked my birthday. I mean, I don't care what they did at the Capitol, but man, that's my birthday.
It's his birthday, January 6th as well. I feel for you. I'm going to be in the Dominican Republic for January 6th. So
you just had a birthday, right, Brandon?
I did. Yeah, it was on December 28th, the weird forgotten time between Christmas and New Year's, but it was a good time.
January 6th is a bad time. It was a bad day to have a birthday, even before the insurrection, because it's like 12th day of Christmas. People are just sick of partying. They're sick of everything. And then you come along and go, hey, it's my birthday. They go, shut up. We're done partying. So,
yep.
Well, happy birthday. All things past, though. My friend Monica did not forgive Monica Lewinsky for many years for hijacking her name and making it
no kidding
a synonym for we all know what.
As long as we're talking about hijacking, let me just hijack this podcast for a moment to say that Kate has this wonderful series of articles about Mike Royko 50 years ago posted to her Roseland Substack, and we should put that into the show notes, because it's really some fun reading, and those who are interested in Chicago journalism and Chicago journalism history will really enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much.
There's a lot going on behind these five voices. So let's start here today. Among the new laws in effect in Illinois this year, and there are many, for instance, October is officially now our state's Italian Heritage Month, as though every month wasn't that in Chicago. No vaping indoors, no video conferencing while driving in Illinois now. Eurasian collared doves are no longer protected wildlife. Your dental records are now the property of the dentist, and so on. Many firearms and munitions are now illegal to buy or sell in Illinois. If you do have one of those so-called assault weapons, you get to keep it, but you should have registered it with the state by Monday, and very few of you did. So what do we make of that then, Austin? Is that therefore a bad law? No enforcement, no compliance? What do you make of that?
I think it's partially a symptom of a bad law. And if you look at some of the complaints that a lot of the people who are passionate about this issue are making, some of them seem very reasonable to me.
Name one.
One of which is that JCAR has not passed finalized rules for the description of what should be registered. So they made that argument in court. We'll see if it holds up. But there is one hearing in particular that comes to mind where a person said, do the accessories that I have to register, what does that mean? Does that mean parts of guns? And the response was yes. And the person said, well, do I need to register this? And it was a lightsaber made out of old machine gun parts. So that is an extremely goofy example. But it also matters a lot when the penalty for not registering something is a misdemeanor and a penalty for not registering a second thing is a felony. So you have, anyone can look at these statistics, they're really interesting. If you Google ISP, so Illinois State Police statistics, they have a dashboard and it shows how many FOID cards there are in the state, how many people registered. So there's 2.4 million FOID cards in Illinois, which first of all, I would not have guessed that it's that high. 2.4 million people with FOID cards in Illinois. The number of people who have completed a disclosure is just under 30,000. And based on polling, we can assume that the real number is as much as 10 to 20 times that amount. So what you worry with here is that people aren't going to people aren't following this at all. If they register them now, they're admitting to a crime.
No, they're not.
They're essentially just saying, show probable cause, get a sheriff to come to my house to enforce.
They register now, pardon me, yeah.
Or get a state's attorney, right? And a lot of the sheriffs are saying, like, I'm not going to go do that. This is not well written. So there's two parts of the law, right? One was you can't sell these weapons. That is somewhat easy to enforce on the, like, store level, right? You can't be a store in Illinois that's selling this kind of thing. This other part of everybody has to register and we're not going to tell you the final rules of what you need to register, it seems like a complete mess.
You could have simply registered everything. I mean, they had plenty of time. They had months and months to register their homemade devices or their devices for which the law was basically written. Your AR-15s, your large magazine, your large capacity magazines, etc. I mean, let's ignore that one example, Austin, but if somebody wanted to comply with the law, they sure could have. Am I right about
Certainly. That? Yeah, absolutely.
And if they didn't want to comply with the law, then I think they have to suffer the consequences of that. I'm not sure what those will be. They're not, you know, all of these people that texted my show and said, this is the first step to them coming to get your guns, is the dumbest, most predictable argument you can possibly throw out there. That is so,
John,
that
you
is
just
so
said,
lazy.
You just said they're disobeying the law, so we need to come get the gun. Like, they need to suffer the consequences.
But they're not. But the implication in that is not that they're going to take the guns that you've illegally kept, but rather they're going to come and get all of your guns. That's what that meme is about. It's like, oh, they're coming to get your guns. Hey, if you got a gun illegally, I have no sympathy for you. If you haven't complied with the law, I have no sympathy for you. But they're not going to come and get every gun. We'll still be armed enough to fend off Canada. We'll be okay.
The thing that I worry about and the like absurdity that I think this kind of a law can create is what we're kind of getting into, which is like, say that there is, so there's polling around that has statistically significant sample of gun owners in Illinois. 32% of them said that they have owned or own an AR-15 or similarly styled rifle. So we got 2.4 million FOID cardholders. Say a third of them have had or have this weapon. You're looking at, what is that, 600, 700,000?
800, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere around there. So in 30,000 have registered.
I know.
Nobody's
playing along.
So then the enforcement becomes like, are we going to go after 500,000 with police, 500,000 people with these? I don't think so.
Well, no, isn't the idea, though, that if they catch you with one of these guns, if you that it enhances the penalties or that they can arrest you if you they're not going to come to your house looking for your gun. They don't have any idea who's got what guns. And I do resonate with the idea that, you know, we have to register all kinds of things, that, you know, like your car, your real property and so on. I really don't have a problem with the idea of a gun registry, of being able to track and trace firearms. I think that one of the real problems is not really private ownership of guns. I think the problem is the loose traffic in guns. The fact that someone can go buy a big bag full of guns in Indiana and sell them on the street, and we have no idea who's got guns, and when the guns are fired and the bullets are discovered, we can't find out who fired them. So I guess I'm not paranoid enough to think that the government is going to take a gun registry and then go house to house and take guns. And if the government does end up with that kind of power, we're in a lot of trouble, and we're not equipped. Even private citizens with guns are not equipped to fight that kind of a fascistic takeover of our government with the guns they have. So I don't consider that particular fear to be valid, and I think we should. I think guns should be registered. You should be. That makes sense to me, and I don't know if there's a reason why we shouldn't do that.
I get that it's a slippery slope, but anything is a slippery slope. So, by that argument, let's not have almost any laws. I would think that realistically, they're going to end up having to issue some kind of advisory on what's included and give some amnesty to people to late file.
Yeah.
But in general, yeah, it just seems like if somebody gets caught with it, either because they're carrying it around outside or their house gets searched, they're just going to be in for greater penalties, which, you know, I can't get too worried about. Sounds good.
Yeah, there may need to be some sort of amnesty. I think that's actually probably a good idea. But I do wonder, I'm not a gun owner in Illinois. So I just wonder what the communication was in terms of making sure you're registered and what the penalties were for that. And, you know, while all of us here on this panel know that there's not going to be any busting in doors and taking your guns from you, the people in the right-wing circles who have that fear and that belief, this doesn't do anything to help dissuade that in any sort of way. I can see how if that's what you believe could happen, it's a fear you have, and you see this, and we just broke down those numbers, you think, wow, I'm a target. We all know it's completely not true, but I can see where that can be led to. So I think amnesty is probably the best idea here. I just wonder what the communication breakdown was, if there was one at all, or was just people just being like, no, I'm not doing this.
You know, that's such a good point, Brandon. There's just no point in making paranoid people more paranoid. We do. Right. I think we should show some grace to these people. And in terms of the communication, I've got a FOIA card because I actually thought seriously about going and taking lessons one time. And you have to get a FOIA card to do that. I never got around to it, but I've got one. And so I'm technically registered. I never got any email or mailed information on this. So how did they contact people?
I just got to say, it's really funny, Kate, that you would say it's a FOIA card.
You're such a journalist. You're such a journalist.
It's FOIA. It's F-O-I-D.
I said that, didn't I? Yeah.
We should make FOIA cards, though. That's cool.
It would be easier. I'd love that. Just go flash it and any office.
No, rules on it.
Freeze, I've got my card.
They've got to give you those documents right now.
You know what I mean, though, okay? Yes. I went to Vegas. I went to a shooting range for fun where they had like tanks and bazookas. And I just shot a regular gun. They really tried to get everybody to shoot a bazooka, but I was like, no, just let me just see what it's like to shoot a regular gun. And, you know, it's kind of fun. I thought I would like to learn how to do this. And then I never did. Well, but I do have the card.
If you want to fire a bazooka, go to Darren Bailey's house because I have in front of me a picture of him. This must have been taken over the holiday. It just posted the other day. But it's a picture of Darren Bailey, who ran for governor unsuccessfully. He's now running for Congress downstate. And there's a picture of him at his dining room table. And he's got all of his big, he's got the big puzzle out there with the pieces everywhere, the borders filled in. Mm-hmm. And then on top of the table and on top of some of the puzzle pieces, he has a bunch of guns, big guns. One of them, by his right elbow, looks like one of those Uzi submachine guns, those little snappy ones. And then he's got some big guns. And he posted with this, "I'll be here putting together this puzzle, waiting for Pritzker to knock on my door and take my guns. I will not comply."
My reaction to that is Darren Bailey is an idiot. And it also strikes me as a threat. Like there's an inherent violent threat in that posting. I'm waiting for Pritzker with my guns ready. And Pritzker's not trying to take guns away. And I mean, it's like, it's paranoid. It's idiotic. It's Darren Bailey. He's running for Congress. almost was our governor. I mean, it just
almost
crazy.
Was our governor.
Well, not almost. I guess he got walloped.
But of the two major parties, he was the nominee for one, so that's almost right there.
Horrifying part of that photo for me, it was like the antique dolls in the background and just the house itself.
That's the part I like.
I was looking at the picture to see what are some of the other little. Oh yeah, there is this one
the clock, and then there's this like kind of folk art looking woman in a hoop dress.
Yeah,
I like that. Right, that's the part I like.
Here, Kate, I'll hold it up again for you. It's right over
here. I want to see the antique dolls, though.
Yeah.
So.
Hold on. Well, here's one. This, I'm going to hold it up. I don't know if you can tell. I'm holding it up to the zoom lens for you. But it's like this.
This is great audio, by the way.
It's scary. So here's Neil Steinberg in the Sun-Times about it. He said he was going to rip on it, but then he said, looking at some of the now 3,000-plus replies, nearly all of them roasting Bailey alive, I did not have the heart to join in. Here are a few choice retorts. Threatening a state governor while confessing what a friendless loser you are is not the flex you think it is, Darren. No one is going to take your guns. Y'all have been crying about this for decades. Now just stop. And somebody else posted, not pictured, friends, family. grief, man. Is this what you sit around and worry about? But this is what you do when you're running for downstate office. Right, Austin? This is a campaign post, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this was like subtle campaign messaging by Southern Illinois Republican standards. Like, this is kind of
that's coy.
You know, like, thing. So, yeah, it's there's a David French had a column in the Atlantic a while back about a term that he called gun idolatry. So it's sort of a form of like aggressive, irresponsible fetishization of weapons. And I don't think it serves people well who agree that we need a strong Second Amendment to do things like that. But as you said, it's if you're in a Republican congressional primary in Central and Southern Illinois, I mean, you should just throw a gun in every picture just because that's yeah. sort of where the base is at right now. And you have to wonder if, you know, we do this game the opposite way a lot of the times, but if someone on the left had posted a picture of them with guns talking about a Republican official, there would be rightfully be people who denounce that. I will say there was it wasn't the only uncomfortable photo from an Illinois political figure. If anyone saw, Alexi Giannoulias keeps taking these photos of himself where his belly's on the floor and he's kicking his legs behind him, working on the computer, and it's deeply unsettling in a completely different way than this is.
He looks like a teenager doing his homework. It's like the TV's on in front of him, and those are really funny.
When he's on the radio, he's not funny. He doesn't play, but he also posted at the beginning of the new year or at the end of the last year some of the license plates that they had to reject, and with that kind of smile, like, hey, but you know. We get it, but you can't do it, but I'm going to do it because I'm your cool Secretary of State.
Some of the rejected license plates submitted for approval this year included Eat Butt, Boner, MILFs, Whoop Ass, D's Nuts, Poopsie, and Iowa Sucks. Clever is too generous a word, but they did make me laugh.
And it was a total fail. It was a total fail. I don't know who his people are, but I don't think he's imaging himself appropriately for whatever his either offices or aspirations are. I always had the feeling he wants to be more than Secretary of State.
I wonder if that feeling was caused by his run for the U.S. Senate, maybe? maybe a little inkling?
I guess what I'm saying is he's not done running for higher office. Since we last spoke, former Chicago City Alderman Ed Burke, that's pretty funny, Eric, whose trial and tribulations we have spoken about a lot on this podcast, was convicted on 13 counts of racketeering and extortion. 38 witnesses over 16 days testified, Burke himself not among them. The jury deliberated over 4 days, 23 hours. Sentencing is set for June. And Eric's readers, Eric, don't think, am I misquoting your Picayune Sentinel? Don't think he is going to go to jail for that?
They don't think that he's going to be spending any time in jail this year. Yeah, that was the concern. This means tomorrow's Picayune Sentinel, which is available online and for free whenever whoever wants it, gives the results of a 36 question survey that I took of readers, what they thought was going to happen during the
but were they asked
year.
That before or after the verdict?
No, this was after the verdict. It was right before the new year that I asked.
Okay, so
this.
After the he was found guilty on 13 of 14 counts, was it 13 of 14 or 13 of 16? Anyway, 13 counts.
Yeah, well, 57% said that he would not spend a day in prison in 2024. And I think their thinking might be that this case dragged out so long after his indictment, 5 years, as Kate pointed out. And the sentencing, it's a sentencing in June. Does anyone know? It's like, it's way, way off.
Yeah, it is in June.
And then after they sentence these people, these white-collar criminals in federal court, they always give them like lots of time to get their business in order. And so it's like it is theoretically possible. I think that he will end up behind bars in 2024, but he's not going to spend a lot of 2024 behind bars. He's going to spend part of it, I think. And of course, the other cynicism is people are going to say that the judge is going to go, oh, the poor guy is 81 years old, and he'll die in prison. He'll die in prison, so this is a life sentence, and so we're going to just sentence him to probation, which I don't know if that's an option for the judge. I don't know what the sentencing guidelines are, but it could well be that the judge will be very, very lenient. That was their thing. I disagree with that. I think he will spend time in prison.
And you think he should spend time in prison?
Do I? Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, he's convicted. Yeah, absolutely. Those are serious crimes that he was convicted of. So
yeah, it's not like he's going to commit them again, though.
But John, we've seen that politicians in Illinois are deterred from being corrupt by the sentences handed out to
yes.
individuals.
Yeah, it works every time.
I was surprised how I, like many, was kind of like a typical Illinois politician is going to get off. They're going to be, they had the little technicality issue they were talking about. So it was a monumental day. I actually voted in that poll, Eric, and I also said that he would not serve time in 2024, partially because of just that. I just felt like sentencing being kicked down, they usually give people a lot of time, and I just had skepticality that they will even give him jail time because of his age. I think he needs jail time, deserves jail time for sure, because these are serious things. You've been convicted of well over a majority of them. You should have some justice served there. I voted in that poll, Eric, that I did not think he would see anything in 2024.
I'm always surprised that guys like him, maybe Blago, Blago would have gotten out in a reasonable amount of time. That is, Blago, even if he had served his full sentence, would have still had a lot of life in front of him. But guys like Burke, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to take my chances. I'm going to get a suitcase of money, and I'm going to go. I'm not going to die in jail. This guy could, each of the counts could go 20 years. Just a moderate sentence could be a life sentence for him. I guess you could read books and talk to your grandkids on the phone once in a while, but I'm surprised some of them don't just pick up and run.
Or like a Brewster's Millions situation where, like, I'm going to get sentenced in 6 months. I got to spend all of this campaign money on the goofiest stuff imaginable.
What can you do with that money? You can use it for your defense, right? And you can give it to other campaigns.
One interesting thing that I forgot about until reading this again after the break was that his top aide, Peter Andrews, he was acquitted of all counts, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
And I think given the evidence presented, maybe a little bit even, like, of course, they got their big fish, Ed Burke. That's who they're going for. But it wasn't as if this person was completely innocent. He had knowledge of all these things, was participating in all of them, and he gave great evidence. But he will not be punished for that, for, I guess, his boss's actions to some extent, but also his own.
That was such a strange, conflicting verdict, yeah. I mean, obviously, Burke was guilty, but so is his aide. There's no telling for sure what will happen, because I think maybe Eric pointed out, I forget, that for all we know, the judge will really take pity on him being old. But, you know, not necessarily. Look at George Ryan. He died in prison, basically.
Right, but he died. He's still alive.
George Ryan?
Did Ryan die?
Hey, Pete, is George Ryan still alive? I'm looking at
Am
my
I
producer.
Wrong? I thought he was.
Breaking news. He's still alive. 89.
His spirit died. You know who died in prison was his wife. That was tough on him. That I went to George's sentencing here. I went to the whole trial, and I remember Dan Webb was up there, just like, you know, rending his garments, saying, "Judge, this man is ill. This is a death sentence you're giving him if you send him to prison, and, you know, let this man go home." And it was just, he's very ill. He's not going to live through prison, and I think. You know, I talked to some people who are more friendly with George Ryan than I am, and they said that prison was actually good for him in a way, that he ate much better in prison and he got in shape a little bit, and so his health actually improved in prison. So anyway.
It's strange, isn't it, that so Ed Burke, though, is caught, tried, convicted, and this year will be sentenced before Mike Madigan even goes to trial. And Burke was only caught because they were going after Madigan when Solis was wearing the wire. And Solis volunteered information, and the guys in the truck went, "Wait a minute, he said what?" And so now Burke gets caught up in this thing. Burke's going to go to jail. Madigan has not even stepped foot in a courtroom yet. Actually, I think he was he in a courtroom today?
Today was the first time.
Yeah,
they were asking to move back his trial based on this case coming out of Indiana.
And in fact, they did. Now he's not going to go in. The trial will not begin until at least October 18th. Talk about running out the clock. I mean, he's in his 80s too. Wow.
And he's a master of procedure unlike any other. So we will now not see a verdict until 2025.
He'll be 82 when his trial starts. So,
you know, whatever you make of all of that, in the case of Burke or Madigan, you know, their age and what do we do with old men who, you know, may die in jail. But the number that's offensive is the years that they were getting away with it. It's the years that everybody knew that Madigan was flying under the radar and Burke was flying above the radar. Everybody saw what Burke was doing and suspected what Madigan was doing.
Yeah, it was an open, for both of these people, it was like an open, not even secret. These guys operate political machines wherein their public policy actions are tightly tied to favors that are given to them on the personal side. And that is still happening today. We don't have strong conflict of interest rules still in the Illinois General Assembly. The ethics packages that have been passed in the wake of indictments in the city council and in the General Assembly have been laughably weak. And we should expect more of this. We're likely never going to get another person who is House Speaker for 34 of 36 years, but we will get a bunch of petty criminals in public office until that changes. And there's really no one. Brandon Johnson had an opportunity after Ed Burke went down to say, here's my agenda, we're putting this forward. He said basically Ed Burke's a bad guy. Yeah, whatever. And that is not unique to Brandon Johnson. That has been elected officials in Illinois for all the way up to Governor Pritzker. They also had very little, if nothing, to say about this. So these things should be used as opportunities to make reforms, but people in power are not interested in doing that.
Here's another reform they should make, since this is the last time we might talk about Alderman Burke. So he's going to jail. He will certainly lose his pension, but Danny Solis, right now, they're saying, is going to keep his pension.
That bothers you?
Which is insane.
Yeah, that would be a yes. Well, but isn't that part of the deal? Isn't that how you get people to comply? I mean, if he plays correctly with the prosecutors on the Madigan case, then there will never be charges against Solis, right? That's still part of the deal he has to fulfill.
Definitely part of the deal is obviously wearing the wire, et cetera, et cetera. He's not supposed to get charged and convicted with anything. That, I would say, should be enough. Keeping your pension also, no. And technically, he doesn't have to necessarily get to keep his pension. I don't think that's not even up to the prosecutors. It's just what they're saying right now, that he's going to be able to keep his pension because he wasn't convicted of anything, which means he wasn't convicted of anything relating to his job. But if you remember, when Larry Bloom got convicted, he was not convicted of something related to his job. They got him on his taxes. Okay, so it was kind of an Al Capone situation. And he went to the pension board and said, I should get to keep my pension because I was not convicted of anything related to my job, which is what the law says. And they said, nope, you're still not going to get your pension.
Who is Larry Bloom?
Larry Bloom, the alderman, used to be from the 5th Ward. He got caught in Silver Shovel. And he was literally the Mr. Clean of the council. So I'm just saying, if the pension board can take away his, they should be able to take away Danny Solis's. I understand that prosecutors would like that little extra thing to throw at people. Oh, I bet you get to keep your pension. But no, they shouldn't get to keep their pension.
Even when they don't get to keep their pension, though, don't they get the money that they put into the pension fund back? Not the pension benefit, but if they look at all the investments you've made and you get that back, it seems like you've gambled.
The gross amount.
It should be you gambled. Yeah, it should be that you gambled and lost. I'm sorry.
But the money they put in is considerably less than what they get back.
Amen to
right,
that.
That's the problem. Yeah.
I want to go on to a few more weightier topics that'll take more than a couple of minutes. So before we do, Let's just get your opinion on Michigan playing for the national championship in college football.
I was hoping to avoid that. That's what. Well, Eric, congratulations to your team. I believe that integrity and truth still matter in sports, and I would hope that Washington wins on Monday, January 8th. Great to have two Big Ten teams in the championship. I think Washington is going to be representative of what most of college football wants to see. If Michigan wins, I think it'll be a waste of a championship because it's probably going to get vacated. So congratulations, though. This is big for Harbaugh and for that program. I was talking trash for so long because they can't win big games until now. They almost lost a big game. They're doing some Michigan, typical Michigan things.
That muffed punt right at the end of the game by Michigan could have been it could have been one of the most agonizing moments in all of sports, the most dumb mental errors that's ever been committed. But I'm writing about that in tomorrow's Picayune Sentinel. I think you could well be right, Brandon, that the NCAA might strip the Wolverines of their championship because of the sign stealing scandal. I don't know how deep that goes, but it's going to take them a while to get that that ruling because the NCAA does not do anything on a.
What do they need to know that? What do they need to know that all of us sitting here don't know?
I don't know. They make the federal court system seem.
I was going to say, talk about justice marching slowly. If the Big Ten can figure it out in enough time to penalize them a few games.
But I got to add something about talking about Brandon's beloved Ohio State Buckeyes, who I was rooting for in that bowl game against Missouri, and because I'm a Big Ten guy, and I was rooting for the Buckeyes, and the problem is that, like, Marvin Harrison, their wonderful elite receiver who may well be a Chicago Bear next year, sat out the game, and you can't blame him for sitting out a meaningless bowl game because he busts up his knee, then he loses millions of dollars. And if he wins the game, big deal. So they had these elite players sitting out. The starting quarterback for Ohio State entered the transfer portal and is now part of Syracuse. So they had a backup quarterback who got hurt early in the game. So they got the third string true freshman quarterback. It was nothing like the Buckeyes that you saw during the season. That bowl game was embarrassing and boring and everything else. And I think, and a lot of these bowl games were bad because of this.
Talk about Florida State.
Yeah, and the Florida State Georgia game was an abomination. I mean, the Florida State, they had most of their stars were sitting out. It was
63-3 was the final on the Florida State game.
And so I think that the combination of the transfer portal and these guys who just refuse to play, which again, I totally understand. I totally understand both of them, but it turns these meaningless postseason games into just farces. And they got to do something about that.
Two big changes I propose. You move the transfer portal and early signing day dates back because it's ridiculous that they have free agency happening before
the final game.
Postseason.
Sure. That's crazy.
It doesn't make any sense. Second, the bowls have to get to a point where they just start paying kids. That's just the way it's got to be. They already give all these student athletes, if it's a PlayStation Bowl, they're given PlayStations. They're given rings. They're given all kinds
Pop-Tarts,
of perks.
Free Pop-Tarts, if you want.
Free Pop-Tarts. But that's money. Like, that's money from the company. So instead of giving them that, just give them money. And I bet you get way less opt-outs if there's some financial benefit.
Well, why would you leave Ohio State to go play at Syracuse, except maybe NIL, name, image, likeness, right? It's maybe there's just such a better financial deal for you. Don't you suspect that's really what's driving this? I mean, if you're playing at Florida State and you're 14-0, you don't want to be on that team anymore? The exodus from Florida State was crazy. That was a JV team they trotted out there.
They got to fix the system a little bit because I think many people are pro players receiving money and benefits for their name, image, and likeness, but there's got to be some regulations.
What about moving the transfer portal till after the season is over for every team?
But I still wonder if those kids would have played, say, at Florida State because, like Eric said, they don't want to get injured.
Well, I mean, if you pay them, most of them are not going to make money as a pro, so you wouldn't have as many people sitting out. But the thing about moving the transfer portal after the final game is that it makes even more of a sham this idea that these are student athletes, I should say, that the idea was, well, they have to transfer because they need to get to the start of the next semester at their new school, and which is, of course, nonsense. But I think moving it back, moving the transfer portal back would be a really smart, really smart move.
Go Huskies. Nice to talk to you, Brandon. I know you got a
cookout. No, go blue. What are you talking about? Go Huskies.
Purple power. I'll see you guys later.
Okay, man.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
A court in Colorado and the Secretary of State in Maine have said that Donald Trump is ineligible to appear on the Republican primary ballot. Several other states are considering similar measures. Arguments for and against have boiled down to two central arguments. A, it isn't for unelected judges and state officials to make such a decision. Let the people decide in the next election who they want, maybe their representative of their party to be or the next president to be. Let the people decide. Or B, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment clearly says that if you incite or aid an insurrection, you are ineligible. It's in the Constitution. People don't get to randomly decide what parts of the Constitution they do or don't want to adhere to. You can't run for president if you're 25 years old. Why? It's in the Constitution. If you don't abide by the Constitution, then you're ineligible. Donald Trump is therefore ineligible, goes the other argument. I see problems with both of those.
If I was the decider, even though I would most certainly never vote for him, I would put him on the ballot because I know it's not in the Constitution that you need to have actually been convicted of trying to incite an insurrection. But that is, after all, one of our other basic values, that people should have due process. So I have a problem with someone getting kicked off the ballot for something that they were not convicted of. To me, it's very similar to any free speech issue. It's very easy to picture somebody who I would like to vote for, being accused of something and not put on trial. But, you know, that's enough. If just accusing somebody and not actually having the evidence to convict them is enough, then, you know, where does that lead?
There was an extensive hearing. I basically agree with you, Kate. There was an extensive hearing in Colorado. There wasn't, I think in Maine, it was just the Secretary of State there made the decision. In Colorado, there was a pretty extensive hearing about the insurrection. And the problem is, of course, that I think that this, the 14th Amendment was in, and the language there was, had in mind the secession, that you had, you know, that they didn't want Robert E. Lee being able to run for president of the United States. Right. And they knew that they wouldn't, if he were tried in a Southern court, he would have been acquitted, yet he was still an insurrectionist. I mean, it's a, you know, the problem we talked earlier about the firearms laws, when they're really vague, then all of a sudden when you want to enforce them, when you think, well, this is an obvious situation, well, maybe it's not. Maybe we don't have a precise definition. I know we don't in the Constitution. We don't have a precise definition of what insurrection is. Is standing by while this riot is going on at the Capitol and not doing what you're supposed to do to stop it, is that insurrection? Is telling people to fight like hell, is that insurrection? So I think you're right, basically. And the other thing is, although I would love to be sure that Trump would not be reelected president, because I think it would be a complete disaster for our country. I also think that he's going to be the easiest Republican for the Democrat to beat next year.
Really? You think Joe Biden can easily beat Donald Trump?
I think he will beat Donald Trump. I think he would have more trouble with a Nikki Haley or even a Ron DeSantis. But I think he would be. I think the polls reflect this, too. Trump would be easier for Biden to beat than Nikki Haley, just for instance.
But, you know, about whether or not he was convicted of insurrection, what does that even mean? That paragraph, which tries to do so much, it does very little. It does say, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. Maybe the problem with that is enemies rather than aid or comfort. But clearly Donald Trump was aiding or giving comfort. We love you. To the people that stormed the Capitol. Now, are they the enemies thereof? Maybe that's the problem with that. But he wasn't convicted of anything, and it's not clear, even if this applies to the former president of the United States, but he did give aid or comfort.
I agree with the murkiness of the constitutional question here, and I also think that it's the start of a potentially concerning trend whereby many state officials in presidential election cycles attempt to do things like this in order to elevate their own political brand. And I think that that is something that will become more common. And that isn't to say that any state action against Donald Trump, that all of that is simply just someone shining a spotlight on them, right? But it is a factor at play increasingly. You could see, for example, in the next presidential election, the pick like the reddest state, pick like Idaho or Mississippi or something. If you're going to have this kind of precedent set for these types of rules applied to a presidential candidate, you can totally imagine the other shoe dropping on that in a kind of ugly way.
Give me an example.
Say the this is going to be a messy one, but like say the Idaho Secretary of State says that can get a court to agree with him that the Democratic presidential nominee was giving comfort to some enemy of the United States, right? Or something like that, right? It's not that hard to come up with something.
Okay, but I'm putting you on the spot here, but I mean, compare that to what we actually had on the ground on January 6th.
It's a difference in scale. And I think I'd struggle to come up with what the hypothetical would be on that scale. But I just, it might not matter, because the point would be that that person in their base hates the other person so much that they won't care what the underlying.
Sure. And we have both at play here, though.
And we're seeing this right now with this Republican effort to impeach Joe Biden over vague offenses that they are yet to figure out what they are. They're trying to impeach him. They're conducting an inquiry to impeach him based on suspicion that he might have done something wrong. So it's not what Austin's saying is not far fetched. You could easily imagine a deeply red state saying, you know, Joe Biden was insufficiently hostile to immigrants coming into the country. Therefore, we consider that to be an insurrectionist act, and we're going to kick him off the ballot. And then you could see a bunch of judges going, yeah, sure, that sounds good. So, yeah, I don't think it's that far-fetched.
Okay, but
I think
then,
it is a
so, all right, okay. So then what about what happened January 6th? Just forget about the comparisons or the contrasts. Just tell that, me
I think what,
how applicable
this is. What Kate
is
saying is you should go through the justice system to get a conviction or find truth or find justice in that from that event. But this, which is essentially a punishment, is being done before that has been proven in a court.
Yeah, which technically is not required in the Constitution. Right. I get that. So I don't blame somebody for having a different opinion than me, saying this is what it says in the Constitution and that's that. I just think long term that it's dangerous, and that much as I hate to say it, I do think that if it gets to the Supreme Court, that they should let Donald Trump be on the ballot. I also don't think it's good for the just overall for the climate, for the divisiveness, to be not letting people vote for who they want to vote for. It's not going to help.
So if Donald Trump robs a bank, and we know it's against the law, but it's Donald Trump that robbed the bank, let's let the people decide if he should keep the money. I mean,
well, no, that is robbing a bank. That is something he would, I assume.
What do you think happened on January? What do you think happened on January 6th? Was there an insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th? And did he engage in or give aid to the people that were doing that? I know I don't have a conviction in a court of law, but I mean, and even I'll acknowledge that this paragraph wasn't written for what happened on January 6th. But I think that peg is pretty round, and so is the hole. I think this fits pretty closely.
Oh, okay. I mean, if you're going to push me on it, I'm going to have to say that as ridiculous as January 6th was, I cannot put it in the same category as firing on Fort Sumter. It was pathetic. It was absolutely pathetic. I think everyone involved in it should get convicted of anything we can convict them of and get the harshest sentences possible. What they did was reprehensible, but I don't think it rises to that level, to the point that I'm certainly willing to let state officials make those kind of decisions that affect who the entire country can
vote. I know that, and I believe what Eric and Austin are saying is plausible. I can actually see what you guys are doing there, but I want to just stick to what happened on January 6th, because otherwise I might lose this argument.
Well, let's take it to court. Let's see you get convicted.
Of course, the problem with court is that they won't even convert it. They would do a verdict for 5 years. And if he does win re-election, then they're going to say, well, you can't prosecute him because he's the president, which I think is probably a pretty sound rule in general. And so then it doesn't even matter anymore, because unless he decides to run for a third term, which I wouldn't put past him.
When this first came up, I wish that those two conservative academics had not reminded everybody of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, because nobody knew about it, and it just seemed to be such a stretch. It seemed to be such a reach. But here we are. All along, for instance, I thought, yeah, that's aiding an insurrection or being an insurrectionist. You shouldn't get to be president. But I never thought that it would come to this point.
Well, an argument that does not hold much water with me is the let the people decide whether this was insurrection or not by letting them vote. And the reason you have a constitution, and people who are so staunch about the Second Amendment will certainly see this also, is you have a Second Amendment as a guard against letting the people decide every issue. If the people decided the gun issue, there would be a lot more restrictions on guns, just for instance. So anyone who's saying, well, let the people decide, if we let the people decide, then we would have to throw out, say, the 35-year age limit on the presidency. We would have to throw out the citizenship requirement for the president, mm-hmm. a born citizen requirement. All this business about where Barack Obama or Ted Cruz was born would be irrelevant. But the Constitution does lay out certain parameters. You can't say, well, maybe Vladimir Putin could run for president of the United States because let the people decide. Well, no, we have a Constitution to prevent that. Because we know that certain principles are so bedrock that they should not be subject to the whims of public opinion, and so I guess this issue about insurrection, it's a shame that it wasn't more clearly spelled out what they mean by that,
right,
because we don't know what that meant, and I guess I'm content to let the courts sort it out, and I hope that however they do, it ends up.
Well, how do you guess the current Supreme Court is going to rule on this, Eric? I'll give you one possible answer. And I guess that's also just another layer of what bothers me about this. He's going to get away with it again. He gets away with everything. He didn't pay his contractors all the way up to he led a rebellion against the United States, and he gets away with that too. The guy gets away with, but one exception so far, everything.
I've seen some speculation that the Supreme Court is made up of largely more conventional Republicans and of course some liberal Democrats, and that they will see this as a really good chance just to get rid of Donald Trump, because I know a lot of Republicans would really like to see his back. And they can't say so, and it's politically toxic because his base is so strong and so rabid, but that it would be a really good opportunity for the Supreme Court to say, well, you know what, this counts as the way we read the law, the way we read what happened, this counts as insurrection. The states are certainly entitled to consider it insurrection, and if they do, then he's off the ballot.
Yeah.
That would basically kill his presidential choices, and the Republican Party would have to look for another nominee. And I think that there are a lot of Republicans who at least secretly hope that that's the case.
That would be great. I'm not going to go out and protest against the Supreme Court if they keep him off the ballot.
Yeah.
I just think it should be up to them, I think, because it's such an important question. I'm just not super comfortable about it going on a state-by-state basis.
Yeah, I would like to see the Supreme Court, and usually their rulings will clarify and discuss what they believe the framers meant, what they believe that amendment means, and that would perhaps would offer some clarity here. And I could imagine them saying, you know, some of the strict constructionists would say, you know what, as much as it may pain us to do this, we have to read the letter of the law and realize that this qualifies as insurrection. We've been listening to John Williams on WGN, and we believe that he is a traitor. This is treasonous and insurrectionist, and he doesn't belong on the ballot.
If they are not just conservatives, but constructionists, maybe they will read it the way they did the Second Amendment, a common use weapon way back then applies today. And that's why we get to have AR-15s in some places. So maybe they would be that conservative in their read of the Constitution. But I have so little faith in this Supreme Court, and I'm not alone in that, that I would be shocked, I say, that they would rule against Donald Trump on this.
God help us in 2024. It's going to be a barn burner.
Kate, let's just talk briefly as we wrap this up about the president of Harvard stepping down. Mm-hmm. I don't even know where to begin on this, but three college presidents have come under fire. And the latest now is the president of Harvard stepping down for what stems from her testimony before a congressional hearing and also for charges of plagiarism against her. That may have been the straw that broke the camel's back, but it was being weighed heavily by what she said before Elise Stefanik. What's your thought about all that?
I may have a different take on this than you all about her testimony. I did not think that she should get fired for the testimony. I didn't even disagree necessarily. I don't disagree with the three of them who were saying that calls for genocide do actually take some context, because if you go by free speech, First Amendment, it does require some context. The problem with their testimony, besides the fact that their delivery was just god awful, you really felt like they absolutely did not care one way or the other.
They were too lawyered up, I think. But keep going.
That was just awful. But the problem was that all three of them were being complete hypocrites, because all three of their schools have terrible free speech records. And Harvard, as you probably all know, was literally dead last in the FIRE ratings this year. FIRE being a Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. For anybody who's not familiar with them, they are a terrific group. They've been around for, I'm going to say, about 10 years. Lots of really...
what do they score? What do they do?
They kind of do what the ACLU used to do for free speech, and they used to only focus on schools' free speech. Now they've kind of taken it, you know, to all free speech. But basically, if there's threats to free speech on campus, they will pay for the lawyers to or advise to deal with it. And every year they do a ranking of the colleges with a very detailed questionnaire to figure out who's got the best free speech climate on campus, you know, based on things like, are they firing professors for saying things that are not politically incorrect? Are they letting the students shut down speakers because they don't like what they're saying? That sort of thing.
They and also poll students, which is interesting, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they took a new name in June of 22. They're now the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. They branched out from just education.
Right. I forgot.
So I admire a lot of what they do, because they try to call out this hypocrisy, and a lot of these elite schools are very hypocritical when it comes to that. I thought that the answers they gave were like too lawyerly, and they failed to challenge Elise Stefanik on what exactly she meant. Because when you say calling for genocide of the Jews, when people say, you know, from the river to the sea, and Palestine will be free, some people hear that as a call for genocide for the Jews, and other people just hear it for like, hey, we want Palestinians to have equal rights in Israel. And so it's a question of like, what do you mean? If someone is out there saying gas the Jews or kill all the Jews,
or specific individuals,
that's specific. And that is I think a category difference in something that some people interpret that way. And I think that's kind of what they were saying. Like, it depends on the context, but it was so badly said. The problem with the Harvard professor was that then after this started happening, then there was this rather major investigation into her academic integrity. She had some plagiarism issues that she dealt with, and the things that I saw suggested that they were pretty sloppy at best in terms of what she did in her academic writing, and that's not acceptable at an institute, not at any institution of higher learning, but particularly not at Harvard. And that investigation never would have happened if she hadn't fumbled the congressional hearing.
You're right. It may not have come out if it weren't for those hearings. I think it's really unfortunate that the two things are necessarily being conflated, because now that people who didn't think that she should resign for the plagiarism are saying that it's really because of those hearings, or it's because of people being racist and just wanting her out because she's Black. And it seems to me they were not going to push her out for those hearings, which I think is right.
I think that's right too, and they stuck by her. If you remember, after the hearings, the Harvard board said, we're standing by her. And then something has changed in the last couple of weeks, and I think it may have been more public pressure, or it may have been that some of their
mega donors
the plagiarism is absolutely undeniable. You go to a lot of different places to see them side by side, her papers and what she plagiarized. And it is, I mean, there's just no arguing it.
It's sloppy at best,
multiple
right?
times.
Sloppy at the very best. And there may be more that came out. The Tribune had a pretty good editorial this morning saying that, Harvard hasn't really been very forthcoming about all this stuff. So we don't know what else there might be. But her resignation was fairly abrupt and fairly opaque, really. So I don't know what to draw from it exactly.
I think they had to push her out because the plagiarism was so obvious. And I looked at some things in the Crimson, and it was very clear that at Harvard, they do expel students at least for a semester, if not an entire year, for a single instance of the kind of plagiarism multiple times. And if a student did that multiple times, they would just be out forever. So, once all that evidence is out there for everybody to see, it's just indefensible. Either they have to stop disciplining students for plagiarism, or they have to get rid of their president.
They reached an untenable situation where you can either be the number one institution of higher learning in the world, or you can have a plagiarist as your president, and you cannot have both of those things. And the way that they handled this, I think, is like the worst of all worlds, because one, they waited. There were plagiarism accusations before the latest round that were totally true. And she still is a dean there, or has a job there, and is going to get paid, I think, $900,000 next year. So, yeah. I mean, everybody's still mad. And the other thing that I thought was interesting about this was, in the coverage of it happening, almost spoke to the dynamic that it spoke to part of the reason that people reacted so strongly to these presidents saying what they said about free speech in front of Congress. The Associated Press headline of this, which they have changed, was "Harvard President's Resignation Highlights New Conservative Weapon Against Colleges, plagiarism. That's wild. Can you imagine an Associated Press headline that's like, "Democratic Party has new weapon, the Associated Press"? Like, that is such a non-journalistic take on what happened, and clearly because they ended up changing the headline. But this whole situation has seemed like a major cultural turning point in the wake of those congressional hearings about, especially in powerful institutions like Harvard, the governing body's, let's say, feelings toward certain progressive ideologies overriding the excellence of an institution. And I think that that's changed tremendously over maybe the last year. You do not see something like this happening in the wake of George Floyd, for example, or in the wake of, every Fortune 500 company making massive investments in DEI departments. Same thing with institutions of higher education. I think there's a serious pendulum swing that is happening on that, and this is just one very high profile example of that.
So what's an example of the kind of free speech or speech that should or should not be allowed, either in the Harvard case or just in general? What should the presidents or boards at these colleges allow or not allow? University of Chicago is very liberal about this. I mean, they're the zenith of that, right? What you almost think they just don't want to get involved. Like, we'll just be completely hands off, y'all.
Well, they don't.
Y'all that's don't hit each other. And maybe that's the only course to take, but then you're ignoring some terrible things. So what's a university to do?
I would say that the best thing that could come out of this is if Harvard and others come around to understanding that the University of Chicago does have the best approach to this. And they've based it, I mean, they studied this back in the 60s with the Calvin Report after all the Vietnam protests, et cetera, when people wanted them to come out and have a Vietnam point of view. And what they came up with was, no, the university itself is here to house people and be a community for people to have this debate and voice their viewpoints. The university is not the one with a viewpoint, because when the university comes out with a pronouncement about what is right and wrong, then it's going to be chilling everyone else's speech, because they might be afraid for their own jobs if the president of the university or other administrators, other at U of C, even specific departments are not supposed to make their own pronouncements about anything, because that means various professors or students within those departments now are going to be afraid to say that they disagree.
Even if the point of view is defensible, like if your view was 9/11 was a bad thing and we support America.
You can't even do that at U of C.
Nor should you, maybe, is the more important point. It's not necessary. It's not your place.
Right. And at U of C, it's really worked beautifully. I mean, what they've done on campus right now is they've allowed the protests on either side for Israel or Palestine. But when the pro-Palestinian protesters broke their rules for how protests are supposed to comport themselves, et cetera, they went and took over the administration building. They arrested them. They told them, you've got until 5 o'clock and then we're arresting you. And then they did. And guess what? They stopped trying to take over buildings, you know, whereas in other colleges, the students expect that they can take over any building they want and pizza and burritos should be sent into them as some sort of civil right, which is.
There were some complaints down there at UChicago about that, right? About the arrest.
Oh, of course.
Saying, oh, we don't have freedom of speech and so on. But you know.
Which is a kind of speech, by the way. You get to say that, but you also have to play by the rules.
Certainly you do. And you know, I'm glad I'm not the person who's making the decision about what is it that constitutes something that crosses the line. I mean, it's always an issue with free speech, which is, you know, at what point are you threatening individuals? At what point are you saying something that is so manifestly unsettling to a community that it becomes almost a hate crime, right? If you're out there holding a sign saying gas the Jews or something like that, that seems to me to be something that should not be permitted on a college campus, and maybe not. I don't know where I draw the lines, where I draw the boundaries. And of course, we all have instinctive and great revulsion for sentiments like that. But a commitment to free expression is often a commitment to countenancing things that are revolting.
And I think a really important thing to recognize is not only what speech is allowed on campus, but what Kate was alluding to, which is what are the institutional stances that these institutions of higher learning are going to take. And increasingly, over the last 5 years, they're taking very public stances on contentious issues, and maybe even not contentious issues. Maybe like a lot of people would agree on what the best thing to do is. But when you're Harvard or you're whatever, an Ivy League school, or if you're just a regular, you know, if you're a state university somewhere, right? Or if you're a community college, if you make part of your mission, for example, the dismantling of systemic racism, there are going to be a lot of people in stakeholders of that institution that say, yes, this is a great idea. But when that comes into conflict with other values that are traditionally in functions of universities, like the pursuit of truth and knowledge, it's going to create situations like this. So not only is it about protecting speech of students, however unpopular it may be, it is also sticking true to the purpose of the institution and being very careful about that.
Exactly. And U of C is so great about this that even the lab school, you know how they have the University of Chicago Laboratory School, the university high school, I'm pretty sure it was the high school science department, put up some kind of land acknowledgement statement, and they made them take it down.
What's a land acknowledgement statement?
Land acknowledgement about we stole this land from Native Americans and we acknowledge this and blah, blah, blah. That's just not allowed at U of C. They took it down. I don't get to brag about U of C's football team. So I'm just still, because I am an alumni, going to go, yay, U of C.
Some of these things, like in that example too, Kate, the absence of that comment would not be noteworthy. You don't have to do it. I felt that way at times about a lot of the companies. When Target would sometimes dip its foot into the LGBTQ issues, or God knows what happened to Bud Light. I mean, you know, is it incumbent upon universities or major American corporations to be part of these conversations? And I don't blame them if they take a pass on that, that if the idea is just let's be a free-form place for kids to figure it out, or let's sell as many houseware items as we can. You could just live in that space, and I don't think I would be critical of you for not getting out of it.
There's no end to that, right, is the point.
God.
Because there's always a new thing that you might, as soon as you comment on one of those things, there's 10 more that are equally deserving of your attention.
Well, aren't you going to talk about this? What about Harbaugh? Yeah. What about the Michigan game? You got to have it. What's your statement about that?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, that's where my optimism comes in. I don't think that a lot of these colleges would want to adopt the U of C stance, but I think there will be quite a few who do it because they will see that it's going to get them out of a lot of future scrapes.
Anything else, Eric or Austin or Kate?
Just take out that Brandon was talking about Michigan football.
You know, you are the one who all along has said that Harbaugh will or should lose his job. And I think you've also said, Eric, that in fact, Michigan should have to vacate the wins and forfeit the championship should they win it, right?
I'm very pessimistic about it. I think that Harbaugh had to know what was going on. If he didn't know, he was out of control of the thing. He said he didn't. I know. I don't know what, you know, maybe it didn't apply to this season. Maybe they didn't steal any signs from any opponents this season. I don't know. We'll see what – maybe the NCAA will tell us in a few years what they think. But I think Harbaugh will be long gone by then. I think he's going to – I think he's jumping to the NFL again.
Yeah. Enjoy the game. And I've enjoyed your conversation today, guys. Thanks for being part of the Mincing Rascals.
Lots of fun.
Go Blue.
That's Kate and Eric and Austin. Brandon had to click out. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Great one, guys. That was fun.
That was great.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for your time, campers. Bye. See you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Woo!
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.